Before I go ahead, a few things. Please turn off your phones or put it on silent. We're taking a video of this event, which we uploaded on our YouTube tomorrow. Also, I just wanted to mention some upcoming events. We've got the Lessons in Dissent documentary screening on the 2nd of December about Occupy Hong Kong and how to create a thriving digital newsroom with the co-founder of Quartz coming in on the 4th of December. Okay, today's topic is about environmental issues in Tibet, more specifically on the looming water crisis in this territory. Our guest speaker has just released an expose called Meltdown in Tibet, which highlights the dark side of China, the rampant exploitation of the area's natural resources through large-scale mining, as well as the installation of dams that are strangling rivers and endangering the rich agriculture and wildlife downstream. The author, Michael Buckley, documented what's really going on in Tibet and calls for change to stop the destruction of the region's environment, especially from these hydropower projects. Buckley is a Canadian journalist, an intrepid traveler of Southeast Asia, having written many travel books about his adventures, including Shangri-La, A Guide to the Himalayan Dream, and Eccentric Explorers. He's also an environmentalist, judging from his recent work. That includes three documentaries about serious environmental concerns issues in Tibet. Clearly, he's very familiar with this terrain in the northeast of the Himalayas in China. Let's hear what he has to say. Everyone, please give a warm welcome to Michael Buckley.
Good afternoon. I'm going to start talking about a guidebook that I did. I've done it for many years in different editions. Started back in 1986 for Lonely Planet, and every two or three years I go back to Tibet to update. That was not a choice, it was something I had to do. They didn't give you a choice. So over the course of that, I switched publishers in the 90s. I switched to another publisher called Brad, and Brad was not every 2 years, it's more like every 4 years. It's a UK publisher. They didn't update that, but by that time it was very difficult to travel around Tibet. So in the course of all this, over the course of the last 25, 30 years, I saw a lot of changes. And what I saw was not, to my mind, they were not good changes. And I was thinking, well, I'm in a unique position here to do something about it, to say something about it. And that's what I did. I started looking at what was written about the dams, what was written about the mining, what was written about the nomads on the grasslands. Very, very little, a lot of academic stuff. But the academic stuff is not very accessible in a lot of times. So it's a little bit sort of woolly, hard to get at, a lot of footnotes. Doesn't really tell you from the heart what's happening. So that's what I was attempting to do. And because guidebook material involves crunching a large amount of data and getting down to a nice little package like this, when you could go much, much bigger, that's the skill that comes in with that, is just taking an enormous amount of stuff. Like, for example, Hong Kong. You come into Hong Kong, and you have to tell me the top 10 hotels. You know, it's a difficult task to do. It's very difficult to crunch that down and put it in a form that everybody can understand that's only a few pages long. So how do you squeeze Hong Kong into a few pages? It's a very tough decision. You have to choose, pick and choose. The must-see things, what do you have the must-see? So when it comes to Tibet, everybody goes to Lhasa when they go there, but very few people go outside of Lhasa. And if they do, they don't go very far. They might go to Shigatse, they might go to Kailash, they might go to a few other places, but nobody goes all over Tibet. There's very, very few people do that. And when I first arrived there, you could go all over. You could go to Kailash, you could go east, you can go west, you can go anywhere you want. Nobody is stopping you doing anything. And then they put the brakes on that. They started clamping down because they realized that backpackers were going everywhere. And they were getting in nooks and crannies that they didn't want backpackers to go because they were seeing odd things happening. And the backpackers actually became the undercover agents that were reporting back to government in exile, Tibetan government in exile, and NGO groups, what's happening with human rights there, things like that. So over the course of doing the guidebook, there's one particular trip, 2005, where I went on a rafting trip. And I was talking to the kayakers. This is a terrifying rafting trip. It's very class 4. I don't know if you've done class 4 in a whitewater in Nepal or something. It's pretty bad. So you're hanging on for dear life. And then during that trip, I was talking to the kayakers, and they said, well, this trip is the first one in Tibet. There's lots of them in Nepal. There's rafting trips all over Nepal, but Tibet's a little bit behind. We don't have skiing, you don't have rafting, you don't have all these sports because it doesn't happen. I don't know why exactly, but they're a little bit behind the thing on the adventure sports. They've actually got some people doing base jumping. There's a lot of people, adventurers come in and without any official permission would just jump off a mountain, much to the surprise of their Chinese hosts. And that was base jumping, because you're not allowed to do that kind of thing, but they did it anyway. And people were climbing mountains there without official permission, which really was a bad thing. So they get out of the taxi and they say, I'll see you in a week, and go and climb a mountain and come back, and usually successful, not always. So we're looking at these adventure sports. The rafting trip for me was a real eye-opener, but it was basically because of what the kayakers were talking about. They were talking about the rivers being dammed. And further down, we passed a small dam. So I started asking, well, how many of these dams exist? And they said, every single river. And I go, no way. I've been to a lot of these places, but I haven't seen these dams. How come I haven't seen them? And they say, the reason you haven't seen them is they're tucked away in valleys, deep valleys, where you, unless you know where they are, you won't see them. The kayakers know where they are because they have to get past the dam sometimes, and they're terrified of getting sucked into diversion tunnels. So you come around the river, and there's a diversion tunnel because they're building a dam. If you go into that, you might not come out the other side. So they have to know where they are. So I said, okay, show me on the map, where are these places? And then I nailed one of them, which was not too far away. It was in the east. And I went and had a look, and sure enough, there's a dam there, a rather big one. I said, well, how come I don't know about this? And how come, you know, if I don't know about it, and I'm writing the guidebook, what are the chances that somebody else doesn't know about it? It'd be pretty large. So then I started checking into it, and what appeared to me to be happening was that Chinese were building a lot of dams in the lower reaches of these rivers, and they're steadily working their way upstream. And that's what they do. They start a cascade, so they start lower down, they get the power from that dam, they build another dam, they keep going up. And eventually they'll arrive at the Tibetan Plateau because they've got nowhere else to go. And once they've dammed the lower reaches, it's a question of, you define the Tibetan Plateau as altitude. Anything above 3,000 meters would be classed as Tibetan Plateau, in my book, anyway. And there's often Tibetan ethnic groups in these regions above 3,000 meters, quite common, because they're herding yaks, and yaks don't like to go below 3,000. They're not very happy below 3,000. They're happy at 5,000, but not 3,000. They're so well attuned to the altitude. So any area above 3,000, you can class that as Tibetan Plateau. Currently, on the Tibetan Plateau, there's only a handful of dams existing right now. There was one finished last week. They just opened it, Jangmu Dam on the Yalongsangpo. First of five dams on the Yalongsangpo. The Yalongsangpo is a virgin river. It has not been dammed, at least on the Tibetan side. It has been dammed on the Indian side, Brahmaputra. There's another virgin river called the Salween, and that has not been dammed either. These are the last wild rivers of Asia. And now there's a plan to put up five mega dams on the Salween. Previously, there were 13 dams planned, and then they were shot down by Chinese environmental groups. They waged a big campaign, and that they got a victory they thought was a victory. Turned out to be a Pyrrhic victory, where they canceled all of the dams. That was under Hu Jintao, I think it was under, previous premier. But when his term of office finished, then went back to square one, and then recently they've decided under a new 10-year plan to double the amount of hydro in China as a green energy thing. So then they went back to the Salween and said, we want five dams here, and they're starting to work on them. As we speak, there's five dams underway. But we're not talking about small dams. We're talking about the largest dams on Earth. So on the Mekong, to give you an example of what's happening there, the Mekong, there are five mega dams on the Mekong. And the latest to be completed early this year, Noisadu, is 5.6 gigawatts, which is just a figure. But when you consider that the Three Gorges is 22 gigawatts, that's quite a large figure. It's a quarter the size of the Three Gorges, size of five nuclear reactors. And if that doesn't affect the downstream nations, then I'll eat my hat. I mean, it's going to have some effect on the fish. It's going to have effect on the agriculture, the nutrients that come in the silt. There's all kinds of effects it will have. Something you can't get away with something that big and have no effect. Small dams, okay. not a mega dam. It's not even a mega dam. It's a monster dam. You can't even describe it in terms of a mega dam. It's so big. I haven't seen this one. I've seen pictures of it. And you can find them on Google Earth. A lot of these things, you just go into Google Earth, which is what we did in for documentary, and you can go overhead, and you can find this dam. And it's so big, you can see it on Google Earth. And you can zoom in, and you can see it, as long as you've got Google Earth that's updated within the last 2 years. So I'm not sure if you actually can see this one yet. You'll see it later, but it certainly exists. So there's evidence right there, and that's evidence that's irrefutable. They can't take away Google Earth. They tried. They tried to blur certain areas under Google Earth, but Google didn't agree with them because Google was kicked out of China. As a matter of fact, you can't access anything Google in China, not even Gmail, not YouTube, which is run by Google, I think. Yes, not Facebook, not Twitter. That's not Google, but anything to do with Google is either delayed or it doesn't work in China. But anyway, I won't go into a lot of details here, but so making the transition, I never go in as a journalist anywhere. I don't go into Burma as a journalist. I go in as a tourist because I don't want to get wrapped up in the red tape and all those things that it entails. And they'll give you a minder, they'll give you a fixer, they'll give you a spy that's hanging onto your coattails. We don't want all this stuff. So I just go in as a regular tourist. And that is the truth. I mean, I am a tourist. It's just that I'm a tourist that's observing things perhaps a little bit too much for their liking. All the details, putting down the details. So I go from tourist writing this thing into maybe environmentalist writing this thing, which is a little bit very different sort of genre. And maybe this is more like an eco-travelogue in some ways because it's not strictly an academic work. And I get accused of not being academic enough, but I never attempt to be academic in the first place. So it's more of a travel situation where I recount a whole lot of tales, things that happen, like that rafting trip, and then put it into terms of what's happening with dams, water diversion, mining, and grassland. And the thing that is most alarming with the rivers is China's attitude to rivers. They think that they own the upper reaches. If they're upstream, they own it. They don't care what happens downstream. They've said as much officially. They've said that what is theirs in their territory belongs to them, nobody else's business, and what they do with that water is entirely their decision. They don't have to consult anybody. They've never consulted anybody downstream for building dams. So if they decide to build a dam that's 44 gigawatts on the Brahmaputra, which they have proposed, you know, I can't imagine what that would do to the poor nations of Bangladesh and India downstream. They will go ahead and do it, and they won't ask permission at all. They think it's not necessary. And some Chinese observers have even been known to say, well, once the water leaves their territory, it's wasted. It just goes into the ocean. Why bother with these people? You know, they're not even using it. They're not even attempting to dam it downstream. So we better use it. And the way they're using it is two ways. One is dams for power, which are now, they can export that power to 3,000 kilometers away by using UHV lines. And the other way they're using it is diverting it. So the massive diversion of water is not underway yet, but is planned. So we have a thing called the South to North Water Diversion Project. It's got three arms. It's got the eastern side, middle section, west section. West section is Tibet. It will go from the Yangtze to the Yellow. And it's an insane project. Well, why divert a river from one river to the other river to give it more flow? They're pretty much both dead rivers anyway. I mean, they've done so much damage to the Yangtze and the Yellow. Why bother? You know, and there's a lot of critics for that project. It hasn't started. It's not really underway yet. But what is more alarming is diversion of water for mining. Because what's coming up next is tar sands oil extraction, northwest Qinghai, also in Xinjiang province and Tarim Basin. And there are indications that on maps that we have seen or put together ourselves, I got a research help with this, somebody reads Chinese. The research help is that there's going to be an attempt to divert water not to the northeast of Beijing for people, it's an attempt to divert water to the northwest. And why would you divert water to the northwest? Because they need it for mining. They don't say that, but there's no other reason. There's no people out in the northwest. Very, very low population. So if you look at the map, there's two diversions. One northeast to Beijing, because Beijing is running out of water, from the south, to get a water-rich south, the drought-ridden north. And then the other diversion is northwest, which could be for agriculture. There's a lot of desert up there, Taklamakan Desert. But I don't think it's for agriculture. I think it's for mining. That would be my guess. And to help me along with this guess, I'm Canadian. China, PetroChina, just bought up several whole companies in Canada. There's a lot of controversies. One's called Athabasca. Athabasca is a specialist in tar sands oil extraction. Now, why would they buy that company? There's only one reason. They want the technology so they can apply it in China. That's why they want it. And, you know, we've done a lot of things to try and stop them getting this kind of technology to no avail, because our Canadian government is all gung-ho to sell things like this, billions of dollars, good for the economy. So there are Canadian companies operating in Tibet, and they use that technology. And there's a lot of protest in Canada, because what's happening is they don't apply Canadian ethics to these situations. They drop any pretense of being ethical in their dealings. So there's a couple of cases where the Canadian mining companies say, we came under the grasslands and it was uninhabited. What they don't tell you is that all the nomads were kicked off that area the previous 2 years. And they're told, because it was a nature reserve, they had to leave. It wasn't uninhabited. It was inhabited by Tibetan nomads, been there for thousands of years. Suddenly told, this is a nature reserve, you have to leave. And then in comes the mining company. And they say, well, wait a minute, you told us it's a nature reserve. Oh, yeah, that was 2 years ago. We changed our minds now. You know, so it's these kind of situations that become a little bit strange, especially with the paper parks. I got a chapter in this book about paper parks. China has massive numbers of parks that popped up in Tibet and Qinghai over the last 10 years, which have nothing to do with conservation. They're not related to any concept that we have in the West of having rangers, patrols, keep everybody out, protect the wildlife. It's nothing to do with that. It is all to do with mining and damming. That's what it's about. And they've been sitting on their laurels for this, say, isn't it great? We created all these green spaces, we got all these green parks. And you say, yeah, where's the rangers? Where's your protection? What are you doing to stop poaching of antelopes? You know, what are you doing about this? Oh, well, yeah, that'll come later. You know, but that is not the design. So, unfortunately, you know, a lot of the world falls for these tricks. There's been a lot of acceptance to say, well, isn't it great that China's setting aside these areas for national parks without going into the background as to why they're there? And it happens to coincide with nomad removal from the grasslands, exactly the same period. They started doing it in 1990, and they're still doing it now. The first big waves of nomad resettlement started in 1990, exactly the same time as they started creating these parks. It's not a coincidence. It's a deliberate policy to put the two together and say, okay, it's a national park, you must go. And these nomads, they've been there for 4,000 years probably. They have incredible knowledge of the grasslands. That's another problem, big problem now. You've got a lot of degradation going on. The deserts are encroaching. And who would be able best to protect the grasslands? The nomads. But they kick them out. They put them in little hovels, and they say, well, you know, go and find another life. But they have no skills. They have no education. So they're lost. All of this knowledge that they have is all lost. So put all of these problems together. They're all kind of related. The mining problem is related to the water problem, because you need enormous amounts of water to engage in mining. If you're going to mine copper, anything like that, you have to wash it, you have to process it. And then that water, when it's been processed, goes back into the rivers. And guess who's sitting at the other end of the rivers? The countries downstream. Well, suddenly, it hasn't happened yet. It has happened in Tibet, where they've had polluted water. And it's actually killed livestock. It's caused water diversion. It's caused a lot of problems for the nomads. That hasn't happened downstream, because these rivers are very powerful and the effects will be dissipated by the time it comes downstream. It's a long way down from, you know, from Tibet, 2,000 kilometers, 3,000 kilometers, a long way down. It will dissipate. But not eventually, it may not dissipate. It may cause a serious problem downstream with pollution. So you get the mining, you get the pollution, you get the rivers dammed, blocked, diverted, and then you get the degrading grasslands. There's all kinds of issues that will come up. And people say that I'm an alarmist, you know, that I'm projecting something that possibly will never come to pass. But I put it to you that this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's going to be a lot worse things coming down the tubes after this. This is only the beginning. Because they're looking at fracking. China has the largest deposits of known shale gas and shale oil in the world. Of course, they want to exploit them. It's an enormously destructive process. There's been a lot of protests in the States about it. They've got large deposits of tar sands. We destroyed part of Alberta in Canada getting tar sands oil. Everybody was, you know, a lot of people were against it, never stopped anybody doing it. So, you know, I think it's actually going to get a lot worse than what it is. And, you know, China has a lot of problems with desertification. One of the last big areas of grasslands in the world is, there's two of them in the Chinese world, is Mongolia and Tibet, and also parts of Xinjiang, not so big. So if they wanted to maintain that hedge against desert, then they should be maintaining the grasslands. What are they doing? They take the nomads off the grasslands. That's not the best way to do it. And then there is a theory that these are not natural grasslands. They've all interacted with yaks, other grazing animals, for centuries. You had herds of wild asses, you had herds of wild yaks, you had herds of Tibetan antelope. They would trim the grass down. But now you don't have those. They killed off most of the wildlife, that's all gone. But now you're taking away the domesticated yaks. There's nothing to keep it trim, which means that the weeds will come up, the bushes will come up, the shrubs will come up, the whole ecology is going to change because you don't have this interaction going on between the yaks and the grasses, right? And the yaks eat everything. They'll eat the grass, they'll eat the herbs, they'll eat the shrubs, and they like it. You know, it's good for them. It's good for the grass, as it turns out. So we don't know what's going to happen once you remove the yaks from the equation. Most of the yaks end up in the slaughterhouse and take away the yaks. They want to deal with the nomads going back to their way of life. What they do is they destroy the yaks. It's a deliberate policy, I think, because they don't have yaks, they can't go back again. It's an irreversible process. Happened to the Inuits in Canada. They took away their dogs and slaughtered them. They couldn't live as Inuit anymore. Didn't have the dogs. They didn't have transport. They couldn't get around. Then they had to settle. They didn't have a choice. So, you know, these policies, I don't think they're for the best. And people say, well, okay, the Chinese have brought civilization to Tibet. They brought modern, you know, they brought modern things in. They brought radios. They brought TV. But then you look at that, and who is that improvement for? Half the time it's not for Tibetans. It's for Chinese settlers, Chinese military, so they can watch the TV being piped in from Guangzhou or whatever. It's not programs that Tibetans are going to be having fun watching. Most of the Tibetans you see on TV are laughing and singing and, you know, playing folk songs. That's about all they do. They don't do much else, you know. So it's a weird situation. I mean, you can actually have a good laugh if you get a Lazarus turn on your TV to see how they show the Tibetans. It's actually quite amusing because they're always at some festival somewhere enjoying themselves. And you go out in the street and it's not like that at all. So anyway, I think I've spoken probably long enough. Yes. Have I? Do you want me to speak longer? What? She's giving me a wrap-up sign. Okay, we were going to throw this open to questions. And one thing before you ask a question, I think I should qualify this by saying I'm a guidebook writer, or I was a guidebook writer until that book came out. So I'm not an expert on everything. I can't be an expert on great glaciology or hydrology or climatology or meteorology, all of these fields. There's a lot of fields involved here. I can only take some educated guesses at it. And there might be people in this room who are more expert at certain fields than I am. I'm only using what knowledge I've seen on the ground. My value is being on the ground and seeing things and putting that in connection with the theories. But for example, I won't take on this theory about Tibet driving the Indian monsoon. There's no proof of what it does. You can guess one way or the other. Maybe it affects the Indian monsoon, maybe it doesn't. I don't know. There's not enough proof. There's not enough models. We don't have the data. So I'd just leave that aside. I would rather not even talk about it, because we don't have enough. We don't know enough about it. And it's the same with the grasslands. We don't have enough information about what's going to happen to the grasslands without the nomads. We don't know. It's been too soon. In another 5 years, maybe they'll find out that was a bad move. So when you ask a question, I try to answer questions, but I don't have a lot of answers to certain areas. And so as long as you keep that in mind. But what I do have is an area of like 20, 30 years where I've been in and out of Tibet. And I've seen what happens, my own eyes. And that's where my value comes in as an observer. And being able to, you know, I was spending 2-3 months of time there and seeing what's happening on the ground and how people are treated. And I'll just give you one example. Tibetans won't talk about certain things because they know they're getting into trouble. And there's a Panchen Lama that's a Chinese one. The real one has disappeared. It was the one that was approved by the Dalai Lama. So anyway, this Panchen Lama came to Shigatse. He comes there once a year. And there's a big poster of him out in Shigatse. And there was an old woman there, and I said, I wasn't speaking much Tibetan. I sort of pointed at this picture and said, you know, well, what do you think? And she goes like this. That means evil eye. So she gave her opinion, but she didn't say anything. You know, but she gave me this funny look, and then she just goes like this. And that's the kind of thing that people are restricted to. They can't really say anything, but they'll still give you their opinion. Some way or another, they'll do it. They're very brave people for doing this kind of thing. But You know, it's very sad that the Tibetans have really no say in what happens to their own environment. They have no say in what happens to their own natural resources, because they have a very long history of looking after their environment. It goes back much further than anything in the West, about thousands of years. The first national park in the States is 1850-something. Tibetans, 4,000 years, 3,000 years ago, they had valleys that were sealed off. That's a national park. That's a nature reserve. So, okay.
Thank you, Michael Buckley. That was riveting. Okay, we're going to start with the Q&As. The mic will be passed around. Please identify yourself before you start speaking, and the organization too, if you are with one. Any questions? Anybody has?
They're speechless.
Really? Oh, no, I see them at the back.
Hi, Michael. Nice to see you again. Arun Nigam. Have there actually been any protests at all from India or Bangladesh regarding what the Chinese are doing on the rivers?
Yeah, there's been a lot of vigorous protests from India, I think. But India has its own dam problems. There's been a lot of protests against Indian dam building, especially in Arunachal Pradesh, which has a very high hydro potential. I think if any nation is going to take on China, not many nations are willing to do it. The only one that is willing to do it would be India. But they've had some very high-level delegations that go to Beijing, and they talk about rivers, and they get shut down immediately. The person says, okay, next topic. You know, they all they get is a piece of paper that says, well, we don't think this dam's going to have much influence on you. End of subject. There's been no real dialogue, especially about the one that's popping up on the Jiangmu. This is the one that worries the Indians the most. It's 510 megawatts. It's big enough to affect the flow and a few other things, but that's not the end of the problem. There's four other dams in that cascade, and they're working on those. So when you add them up, and some of those are bigger than the initial one, that's going to be something like 2 gigawatts. And that is going to have a big effect on the flow of the river. But the flow of the river it's also getting fed by meltwater, by glacial water, by monsoon rains, and then other feeders which come in from many other rivers. So it's not all coming from Tibet. It's coming from many different sources. So when it turns the corner, the Brahmaputra, it's getting lots more rivers coming in on the Indian side. So the Chinese argument is that by the time that river leaves Tibet, it's not the full flow. It's only a quarter of the flow. So what does it matter if we dam it? But that's their attitude. They're not concerned with what happens to the water after it leaves the territory. And then often they're damming very close to the border, the same as India is damming close to the border with Bangladesh, because they want to use that river themselves without it being blocked. So they try and put it right as close as they can to the border. But in the case of the Yalom, they can't do that because of landslide areas further down. It's very unstable ground. So I don't know if that answers your question, but India is the one that could take on China, but has not made any headway yet. In terms of, they have no water sharing agreement. India has a water sharing agreement with Pakistan, they have a water sharing agreement with Bangladesh, but they cannot do it with China. No nation has any water sharing agreements with China.
Okay.
There's something like 19 nations around China, I think 16 to 17, I'm not sure what the figure is. But it's a lot of nations and they have no agreement.
Okay, anyone else for questions? Oh, we have a gentleman over here.
Nick Thompson, no affiliation. What can the rest of the world do?
Sit and pray. No, I think, you know, a lot of these problems that came up, they were not there 20, 30 years ago. Not in Tibet, anyway. They might have been in China, but they weren't in Tibet. There weren't any mega dams in Tibet 30 years ago, to my knowledge. The grasslands were still good. There was mining going on. It was small-scale gold mining, individual contractors. So if we can go back to that position from 30 years ago, we wouldn't have so much of a problem. And this, with dams, it's very easy. You just cancel the dams. There's 5 dams coming up on the Salwinds. One piece of paper, they just cancel them. But they won't do it because they're trying to get this target of, you know, doubling their energy output from dams, hydro, by 2020. They want to double. It's taken 60 years to get this far, and now they want to double in 10. That's an enormous amount of hydro. And where's it going to come from? It can only come from Tibet. They've dammed the rest of the rivers to heck. They've got nowhere else to go. It has to go up to Tibet. And they've got very big problems up in Tibet with technical issues because they get freezing and warming all the time. It's happening day and night. So they have to use special cement. to build these dams. They've got a lot of technical problems. Once they overcome those technical problems, you can be very sure that they're going to start multiplying the number of dams. So it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. So the answer to that question is the change would probably have to come from within China to alter these policies, cancel those dams, cancel the mining, and go back to what we had before, which is not so much of a problem.
Any more questions from the floor? Oh, I see right up there in the far left.
Thank you for your presentation. My name is Pamela Bennett, no affiliation, but I'm interested in your comments, Michael, about recently China and America signed an agreement about carbon emissions, and your story now seems to put pay to that given the mining activity that you're suggesting will occur. I'd appreciate your comment.
From what I understand, the announcement was about the year 2030. Is that correct? That, for me, is garbage. Why are we talking about 2030? We need to do something now. You know, by the time we get to 2030, Xi Jinping could be dead. You know, he's not going to be around. Whatever he agreed to, whatever piece of paper he signed, it's going to be useless. You have to have an agreement that I don't accept that they're talking about 2030. I don't even understand why they're talking about 2030. They should be talking about 2020 at a minimum, and maybe they should be talking about 2015. Because this is happening now, and nothing is being done now. Why are we talking about 15 years from now? It doesn't make any sense. And as we know, a lot of Chinese promises don't actually come to fruition. I mean, we've got an example here right in Hong Kong, don't we?
Yes.
Well, then would you trust what they're saying about 2030? I don't know. Looking at it from a Hong Kong angle, I don't think so.
Any more questions from the floor? We still have room for a few questions. Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. And then, okay.
Obama's not any better than Xi Jinping, by the way. Obama made a lot of promises about the environment. He's never done anything. Recently, he said that the carbon emissions would be reduced by 2030. He's not going to be around. His term of office is finished.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley, for your presentation. My name is Carmen Chong, National Press Association. And I just want to ask one thing. What do you have any idea why the Tibetans and the local government build so many dams in that area? It's a plateau. So do you have any idea they build the dams for what purpose?
Yeah, a very good idea. It's got the greatest hydro potential in the world because the drop is coming from 5,000 meters, or let's say 4,500. It's going down to 2,000 meters. When you have a huge drop of water like that, the hydro potential is enormous. So in the Great Bend of the Tsangpo, they have the highest hydro potential in the world. There's no dam at the Great Bend now, but that's where the plans are. On the other side of the mountains, in Arunachal Pradesh, India, this is far and away the greatest potential for India. There's something like 200 gigawatts of energy stored up there, and they're all fighting over where to build the dams and how to stop them. Other people are protesting. Then on the other side, you've got Bhutan, Nepal. They have their own sources of hydro because the mountains are like that. The rivers are not coming through from Tibet. They're starting on the Nepalese side. They're starting on the Bhutanese side. Some rivers go through. So around the world, this has the greatest hydro potential of any area on Earth, and especially the Great Bend. That's got massive potential, absolutely massive. But it's also a highly earthquake-prone zone, both on the Indian side and the Chinese side, Tibetan side. And there have been a lot of controversy over where, you know, the building of these dams, does it affect earthquake areas? Does it precipitate earthquakes? No proof. But the big earthquake in Sichuan, I believe it was 2008, was linked to the building of Xipingpu Dam. And if it was not connected, they had another problem, which is that dams started to crack due to the earthquake. And they said, in the news report, they said they rushed to empty water from 100 dams in that area, big and small, more than 100. That gives you an idea of how many dams there are. I'm not even talking about the small ones. I'm only talking about the big ones. And when they emptied the water from some of the mega dams, they forgot to tell the Thai people downstream that they were doing that. And suddenly there's a huge tidal wave, like a tsunami came into Thailand. And they said, well, what happened here? They're emptying the dams, all the reservoirs, because they're afraid they're going to crack and swamp the people downstream, which they did. Swamp their own people in their own villages inside China. So, you know, the dams and earthquake is another whole issue. And a lot of the area in the Himalayas is earthquake prone, seismic zones. And they say that dams can actually trigger earthquakes because you're moving enormous amounts of earth around. It can actually trigger an earthquake.
Okay, we have time for one more question. I see a hand over there.
Thanks. Nick Thompson again, no affiliation. How are they financing them? Is it all internal finance?
Financing on dams, it's a big machine that comes from the top. It's all government.
Central government. Yes.
Central government. They do the banking. It's a couple of Exim Bank or something. There's a couple of, but they not only do it in China, they do it around the world. They'll do it in Africa. They'll do it in Burma. They provide all of the financing. They'll put the Burmese in debt for the next 20 years or whatever. They'll throw the dam in there, and then they'll export the power back to China. But across China itself, it's all run by very well-connected families that have the money, and they actually own a river. Like the Mekong River has been leased out to one particular family company, and only they have the rights to build dams on that river. Nobody else, only that company. I can't remember the name of the company offhand. And then they're doing the same with other rivers. They're saying, okay, you have the rights to this one, you have the rights to this one. And it's all connections, and in China, it's not a conflict of interest to award a contract to your family member. You know, say, okay, here's the concrete we need for this dam, I'll give it to my brother. You know, that's not a conflict of interest. In Canada, that would be shot down immediately, and this person would be fired somehow from their position. They'd be asked to resign. That doesn't happen in China. That's actually encouraged in some ways, I think.
Is there any international convention about warning people downstream? Because I was working in Korea when the North Koreans opened the sluice gates on some of their dams and wash people away in South Korea.
Yeah, well, this is another interesting issue. You can use dams as a weapon. And you say, listen, if you don't you don't play ball with us, we'll just open the things and flood you. So Brahma Chalani from India has actually, he has a piece that he wrote for a news, he's a water expert, India strategist, geopolitical strategist. He had a piece called Water is the New Weapon in Beijing's Armory. And they say, you know, if you don't play along with us, we'll play around with your water supply. We'll start turning it on and off when we feel like it. And, you know, that's a threat that they can pose to the countries downstream because they have such powerful dams that are so big that you can turn them on and off and you can divert the water. You can stop the water right there and you can actually have the Mekong run dry if you wanted to. And just because they have five dams, they could easily stop it if they wanted to and then just divert that water through the reservoir. So that's it's another issue that I didn't really get into it that much. I mean, there's a lot of things in this book that I don't really talk about because we don't know enough about it. And it hasn't really happened to some degree yet. It will happen at some point. But the thing is that the UN has this thing called the Water Crossers Agreement. It started in 1997. It's an agreement about water sharing. And they needed 30 signatures to get this signed into law. They got the 30th signature this year from Vietnam. It took them 17 years to get the signatures, but that agreement is non-binding. It means that nobody has to follow it. And the only country in Southeast Asia that signed it was Vietnam. No other country, this is how they don't trust each other, no other country in Southeast Asia signed it. I think it was Uzbekistan signed it, or some other country in Central Asia. I wouldn't even class that as Asia. And what kind of rivers do they have up there? I'm not sure. So there's only one country in whole of the area that signed that agreement and made it law passed this year, but it has no binding force, and China just is completely ignoring it. Of course, China didn't sign it, nor did the US, nor did Canada, to my knowledge. I think a lot of countries didn't sign it.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Michael Buckley. His book is available at the front for if anybody wants it. Thank you, everyone, for attending.
Nice. I think we still have some time to mix and mingle. And it'll be good to, you know, ask some more questions if you want. You can corner me to ask some questions. And also sign some books over here. What, turn this off?